Russia accusing Ukraine of staging new civilian deaths in Ukrainian towns in a bid to pin the blame on Moscow. Protesters in Sri Lanka demand their president resign as his government loses majority in parliament. Also in the headlines, China's most populous city, Shanghai, extends its COVID restrictions after a new surge in daily cases. I'm Behruz Najafi. Welcome. Now, Russia is accusing Ukraine of staging new civilian deaths in a number of locations in an effort to pin the blame on Moscow.
According to confirmed information, in Moshchan, village some 23 kilometers northwest of Kiev, soldiers of the 72nd Ukrainian Main Center for Psychological Operations conducted another filming of civilians allegedly killed by the violent actions of the Russian armed forces. The footage is meant for distribution via Western media outlets. The Ukrainian special services organized similar events in Sumy, Konotop, and other cities.
The spokesman did not disclose how the defense ministry obtained the information. On Saturday, dozens of bodies, some with their hands bound behind them, were discovered in the town of Bucha near Kiev after a withdrawal of Russian troops. Ukraine has blamed Russian forces, with President Zelensky describing the killings as war crimes and genocide. Several European countries, including Germany and Italy, have expelled dozens of Russian diplomats since then. Moscow denies any responsibility. It says the accusations are baseless and a clear attempt to smear the Russian army. It says the expulsions of Russian diplomats are regrettable and will lead to a reciprocal response. In the meantime, EU finance ministers are meeting in Luxembourg to discuss possible sanctions on Russian oil and coal after allegations of war crimes in Ukraine. Officials are seeking to finalize a package of sanctions ahead of a meeting of EU ambassadors on Wednesday. Europe is under pressure to head Moscow in the crucial energy sector, but a bloc is divided over the issue. Countries like Germany, Austria, and Italy are heavily dependent on Russian energy supplies and have resisted calls from the U.S. to expand the sanctions to include gas or oil. Germany says it would consider backing a European Union embargo on Russian coal. Reports of potential new sanctions on Russia have sent oil prices surging again as consumers already struggle with high energy bills. The Ukrainian president says his country has no option but to hold negotiations with Russia to end the military conflict, which is now in its 41st day.
All of us, including myself, will perceive even the possibility of negotiations as a challenge. I am not even talking about the content of the talks. The challenge is internal. First of all, one's own, human challenge. Then, when you pull yourself together and you have to do it, I think that we have no other choice.
Zelensky was speaking after leveling allegations at Russian forces that they massacred civilians while withdrawing from areas around Kiev. The Ukrainian president repeatedly called for direct talks with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. Now, Zelensky acknowledges that such talks weren't possible, but he gave no details. The Kremlin says that the meeting can only take place once a document has been agreed. Russia and Ukraine are currently engaged in intensive peace talks via video link. The conflict has already devastated Ukraine, killing more than 1,000 people and leaving some 7 million others displaced. In the southeastern port city of Mariupol, officials say that 90% of the city has been destroyed as Russian forces are still trying to take hold on it. And NATO says that Russia is pivoting away from the Kiev region to eastern and southern Ukraine to try to take the entire Donbas and create a land bridge to the Crimean Peninsula, which it controls. Now, in other news, Russia is critical of the U.S. deploying atomic weapons in non-nuclear NATO states, insisting that they must be eliminated from Europe. Deputy UN Representative Dmitry Polyansky says Washington is violating the Non-Proliferation Treaty. He says that the U.S. non-strategic atomic weapons are kept in non-nuclear European states, adding that such weapons and their delivery means are even being modernized. Speaking at a meeting of the UN Disarmament Commission, Polyansky also criticized the involvement of NATO's non-nuclear members in nuclear weapons training under joint missions. He rejected the idea of Russia using nukes in the Ukraine conflict and said that Moscow would only use its nuclear potential in response to similar attacks against it or its allies. Russia and the U.S. possess around 90% of the world's atomic weapons. Now, we've talked to historian and author Markus Papadopoulos, and here's his take on why Americans continue to have nuclear weapons in Europe.
It is my submission that the reason why the Americans continue to have nuclear weapons in Europe is to ensure that America remains politically, economically, and militarily in Europe, and that Europe continues to remain in the stranglehold of Washington's. Indeed, we can say the same about NATO. The very reason that NATO was established in the first place was to keep the Americans in Europe, the Germans down in Europe, and the Russians out of Europe. Despite how destabilizing American nuclear weapons are in Europe, the Americans nonetheless will continue to keep them there because, as I said moments ago, it is a way of preserving American influence and power in Europe.
Sri Lankan demonstrators demand the president step down following mass resignations by cabinet members amid a deepening economic crisis. President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's government lost its majority in parliament after at least 41 MPs walked out of the ruling coalition on Tuesday. The newly appointed finance minister also resigned just a day after taking office. The president dissolved his cabinet on Monday and sought to form a unity government as public unrest grew over his handling of the economy. The opposition rejected the offer and asked him to step down. Sri Lanka is under a state of emergency, and security forces are bracing for potentially violent protests. People are facing severe shortages of essential supplies, sharp price rises, and crippling power cuts.
Violent clashes between Sri Lankan police and anti-government protesters across the country have become commonplace in recent days. The protesters are angry at the government's handling of the country's worst economic crisis since its 1948 independence from the United Kingdom. The economic downturn has led to long lines for fuel, a short supply of essential goods, and seven-hour-long power cuts every day. The protesters are calling on President Gotabaya Rajapaksa to resign. The president, however, remains defiant. He declared a state of emergency on Friday and announced a curfew to quell the protests. However, the demonstrations show no sign of dying down anytime soon. The government blames the COVID-19 pandemic for the devaluation of the national currency and other economic woes. It says the outbreak has slashed revenues from tourism and the inward flow of foreign exchanges. But that's not the whole picture, at least according to economic experts.
The situation has been exacerbated in Sri Lanka due to the mismanagement, the political crisis, the corruption. The president and the prime minister are brothers. One of the nephews is a minister in the government. So it's extraordinary sort of nepotism which is happening in Sri Lanka. So that's one of the contributory factors.
A government expenditure that exceeds its income, ill-timed tax cuts, and a sudden shift toward organic farming that hamstrung the food industry in the country are also cited as reasons why the Sri Lankan economy is now in the doldrums.
To stay afloat and get itself out of the economic quagmire, Sri Lanka has a few options outside of turning to the International Monetary Fund. The island nation has received 16 IMF loans since it joined the financial institution in 1950. But opinions are divided whether the country should go for another loan. Many believe such international lenders are the root cause of economic crises in countries like Sri Lanka.
Sri Lanka is facing imminent default with over $7 billion of debt due this year, $1 billion of which are international bonds that will mature in July. This is while the country's usable currency reserves are estimated to have fallen to as low as $500 million. To stave off defaulting on its debt,
Colombo has turned to regional superpowers, India and China, for bailout loans, securing a $1 billion credit line from the New Delhi late last month. But that's far from enough, which leaves Sri Lanka with not many more alternatives than the International Monetary Fund. But securing a loan from the IMF will come at a cost too, as the international lender would require Sri Lanka to implement fundamental changes to its fiscal and economic policies, something that experts believe would put much more pressure on the poor. Besides, as some commentators suggest, the demanded restructuring could infringe on Colombo's sovereignty.
As soon as IMF loans money to any nation, they want austerity measures. What that means in simple language is they want subsidies to be taken away from basic things that ordinary people use. Because what you've got to remember that in a developing country like Sri Lanka, the main budget of the ordinary masses is on food and accommodation and energy. They don't have any sort of residual income to buy luxuries. And if inflation goes up by 40% in these sectors, then it has a huge impact on the ordinary people.
No matter what route the country will choose, one thing is for certain. As long as the current economic climate stands, the developing nations would suffer under skyrocketing consumer prices, fuel shortages, and power cuts, which means more protests and political uncertainty in the indebted nations.
Now, officials in China's largest city and economic hub, Shanghai, are extending restrictions on transportation amid a surge in COVID cases. The restrictions will see more transportation networks, including subway lines, suspended. The entire population under lockdown was tested for Omicron on Monday. The mass testing raised the number of asymptomatic infections by almost 25% to over 13,000. Officials also extended lockdown to Shanghai's western parts. That means more than 25 million residents will be under restriction until further notice. Tens of thousands of medical and military personnel are overseeing the operation there. Now to Pakistan, Supreme Court again adjourns without ruling on whether Prime Minister Imran Khan's decision to dissolve Parliament ahead of a no-confidence vote was lawful. The court will hear arguments put forward by government and opposition teams on Wednesday. Khan lost his parliamentary majority last week after a key ally switched sides before a no-confidence motion in Parliament against him. Deputy Speaker blocked the debate on the motion, triggering a full-blown political drama. The crisis deepened after Imran Khan asked the presidency to dissolve the National Assembly and call snap elections. A united opposition is calling the decision unconstitutional. Khan's cabinet has also been dissolved in anticipation of fresh elections. The Prime Minister is accused of failing to revive the economy and tackle corruption, but he blames foreign conspiracy, claiming that opposition figures have colluded with the U.S. to topple him. Washington denies any involvement. Now, suffering at its peak in Afghanistan, a new study indicating that almost all Afghan people consider their living conditions to be so dismal to characterize as suffering. According to the Gallup survey, 94% of people have rated their lives poorly enough to be considered suffering, and that's the highest level measured for any country since 2005. The study shows that the percentage of women suffering is higher than that of men, and that women are more pessimistic about their future. With the entire world now focusing on the conflict in Ukraine, Afghanistan has been deprived of the attention and humanitarian assistance it much deserves. The situation has become even worse since the Taliban's takeover last year, with the world refusing to recognize the Taliban government and the United States freezing billions of dollars worth of Afghan assets, humanitarian aid to the country has almost entirely dried up. While we reached out to activist and journalist Fra Hughes to have his take on Afghanistan's worsening humanitarian crisis, and he believes that releasing frozen assets is the least that Western countries can do to help alleviate the situation there.
Those assets belong to the Afghan people. So at a very minimum, those monies should be released by foreign Western banks, governments, and institutions to immediately alleviate the causes of the food scarcity, food shortages, and the, you know, the deaths that are unnecessary, that are occurring every day. And yes, as a byproduct of poverty, as a byproduct of lack of education, people can be drawn into very fundamentalist ideological groupings. People who are looking around, who want to blame someone for the circumstances they are in, could very easily blame the West, and I would totally understand why people would do that. And it's a short step from saying America, Britain, and EU are responsible for the unnecessary deaths occurring every day in Afghanistan. So there is a danger there, but that danger could be very easily averted if the West, which has no intention of helping Afghanistan, they're talking about giving like $330 million aid from Britain, $220 million of aid from Germany, $200 million from America. This is a drop in the water, a drop in the ocean for a country that needs over $4.4 billion.
In Kuwait, the government of Prime Minister Sabah Khalid al-Sabah has resigned just 3 months after being sworn in amid disputes with Parliament. Al-Sabah tendered the resignation of his cabinet a day before a no-confidence vote against him. Lawmakers brought the motion accusing the premier of unconstitutional practices, including corruption. Members were set to vote on Wednesday. A growing political feud in the oil-rich Persian Gulf chiefdom has held up vital fiscal reforms, hindering the process of relieving economic stress. Low oil prices and the coronavirus pandemic pushed Kuwait's deficit to over 16% of its GDP last year. The financial stagnation has spread deep disillusionment within the country's political system. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we said that Imam Khomeini strongly criticized the cinematic art of the previous regime, as it was one of the main sources of immorality in society, particularly among the young generation. He correctly believed that the dramatic arts, mainly cinema, were the tools of colonial policies of the West and anti-Islamic propaganda of the US and its accomplices in the country. This week, we are going to discuss Imam Khomeini's views on political parties and groups, which were, in fact, the puppets of the big powers in Iran. Stay tuned, please.
Thank you.
During the years of struggle against the despotic Pahlavi regime in Iran, different groups resorted to various methods to topple the ruling system. Mujahideen Khalq Organization, or MKO, was one of those groups which tried to change the political system via armed struggle. The MKO was formed in 1965 with combination of two contradictory ideologies of Islam and Marxism. This organization managed to take a few terrorist acts against the regime, but in 1971, many of its leaders were identified, tortured, or executed by the intelligence apparatus of the regime, called SAVAK. In 1975, some of the MKO ringleaders, through an organizational coup, officially changed the ideology of the group led to Marxism and committed gruesome murders against their opponents thereafter. Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, there emerged differences of opinion among the MKO leaders and the revolutionary leaders to the extent that, following the dismissal of President Abolhassan Bani Sadr by the parliament, the MKO started armed activities against the Islamic Republic system and martyred a number of officials and thousands of civilians. After the Iraqi invasion of Iran in 1980, the MKO terrorist outfit transferred its base to Iraq and continued its measures against the Iranian nation. Some of the Western countries tried to put the name of the MKO in the blacklist of terrorist groups to stop its crimes against humanity. But through the pressures of influential regimes, especially the United States, they failed to pursue their demands. The terrorist outfit has been employed by Washington, Tel Aviv, and London as a tool to pursue their nefarious goals against the Iranian nation and the Islamic Republic system. The founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, writes in his testament, "My advice and recommendation to the groups, grouplets, and persons who are active against the nation, the Islamic Republic and Islam, first, in addressing their ringleaders inside and outside the country, is that the long experience of taking any measure, designing any plot, and resorting to any country and official should have taught to you, who consider yourselves as knowledgeable and wise, that the course of a selfless nation cannot be misled by resorting to terror, blast, bomb, and baseless and uncalculated lies. Never can any state and government be toppled through inhumane and illogical methods, especially a nation like Iran, whose young children to its old women and men are sacrificing their lives in the way of the goal, the Islamic Republic, the Quran, and religion. You know, and if you do not, you are thinking very naively that the nation is not with you and the army is not with you. And if you suppose that they had been with you as your friends, your bungling acts and crimes that have occurred through your provocation have separated them from you, and you have failed to do anything except forging enemies." Unquote.
Thank you.
Imam Khomeini, addressing terrorist groups, especially the MKO, writes in another part of his testament, "In the end of my life, I benevolently recommend you who have started fighting and countering this afflicted nation, which has saved itself from the oppression of criminals like the Pahlavi regime and the world devourers of the East and the West through sacrificing their best children and youth. How can the conscience of a human, no matter how wicked it is, to be content for the likely achieving of a position to behave his country and his nation in this way and does not have mercy towards their young and the elderly?" The Imam advises the ringleaders of these grouplets not to be deceived by big powers. He writes, "I advise you to give up such useless and unwise acts and not be gulled by the world devourers. And wherever you are, if you have committed crime, return to your country and the lap of Islam. Repent, as God is the most merciful of the merciful, and the Islamic Republic and the nation will, inshallah, forgive you. And if you have committed a crime that God has determined your decree, still return from halfway and return. Or if you are not brave enough, accept the punishment, and hence, save yourselves from God's painful punishment. Otherwise, wherever you are, do not waste your life anymore and embark on another job as it is to your benefit." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, addressing the internal and external advocates of the MKO terrorist grouplet, writes in his testament, "Then I recommend their internal and external advocates, for what motive do you waste your youth for those whom have been proved to be serving the powerful world devourers and follow their schemes and have been fallen in their traps? In whose way are you wronging your own nation? You are the beguiled of them, and if you are in Iran, you're witnessing that the million-strong masses are loyal to the Islamic Republic and sacrifice for it. And you are witnessing that the current state and regime are wholeheartedly at the service of the destitute. And those who are spuriously feigning popularity, being mujahid and devotees of the people, have embarked on enmity against God's people and have beguiled you simple boys and girls for their purposes and the purposes of one of the world-devouring poles of power. Whereas they are either reveling in the lap of one of the criminal poles or inside the country, they are leading a luxurious life in team houses like the houses of the wretched criminals while sending you youth to death. My kind advice to you teenagers and youth inside and outside is to return from the wrong way and be united with the deprived of the society who are serving the Islamic Republic wholeheartedly. And be active for the independent and free Iran, to that the country and the nation get rid of the evil of the opponents and all continue noble life together. How long and why will you be subordinate to those who do not think except for their vested interest? You are fighting your nation in the lap of the superpowers while they have sacrificed you for their sinister purposes and seeking power."
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
There's a massive problem of homelessness in the UK, and it seems to be getting worse during the COVID-19 pandemic. There's also an ethnic bias in the statistics, with black households more likely to suffer the issues of homelessness than the white population. How can this be happening in a country with considerable wealth and one of the six largest economies in the world? One striking contrast is the difference in the life of the Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who has all the advantages of personal wealth and an apartment in Downing Street, while every night many sleep rough within sight of the street where he lives, but a million miles from how he lives. It's a situation that has been brought to prominence by the current pandemic, as key issues associated with homelessness have been left unresolved, while the government struggles with a host of problems in relation to the rapid spread of the disease through the general population. COVID's impact has left a mark on the most vulnerable in terms of housing and homelessness. In most difficulty, those in emergency accommodation plus the large community of rough sleepers carry on trying to cope in temporary accommodation or in the streets of London and beyond. They represent a large group of residents of a country hit by an accommodation epidemic, as the government seems unable to fix one of the biggest and most pressing problems facing hundreds of thousands of men, women and children in Britain.
How does the public feel about a Prime Minister living in luxury while many face accommodation problems or sleep rough not far from his Whitehall residence? And what do thousands living in the streets of Britain's capital city tell us about the state of the nation and its future prospects? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. How do those in the capital feel about the homeless situation in the UK? That's what we asked people here in East London. This is what they told us.
It's very, very tough. Either they put the rent very high, the private landlord, they got the rent is higher. Number two, the homeless, too many. In Tower Hamlet, too many drugs, too many things going on, too many. Even the mayor of Tower Hamlet, he don't care. We have complained to our councillors and the members. They don't bother anything. They don't care about these things.
Of course, no one likes to stay in the outside of homes, in the streets, but the conditions and the life is pushed towards people to that way.
I don't know. This is just an opinion. I think it's probably on the rise. I think there's a lot of issues that need to be addressed. Yeah.
You don't have the place to sleep in. You're sleeping outside. So it's very terrible.
Well, I'm not very happy about it. I think they should have more help rather than seeing them sleeping in the street in a big city like London. I don't think it should happen. That's my thing about it, really.
Honestly, I feel like it's a bit dumb that people ain't helping the homeless to get better shelter, if you get what I mean.
I think it seems like a big problem. I mean, when you walk in the streets of London, you can see that there are a lot of people who are sleeping outdoors and they're looking for a place to stay, and particularly over Christmas when the winter months are really, really cold.
I think the homeless crisis that we have in the UK is just rising. So if you look at Australia, India, even America, it's just rising. And we've got to make a difference in the UK ourselves.
They have to sleep outside, and it's not good for us and for the community, for the state.
You know, everywhere I go, majority of the time, I see people, you know, and obviously it's terrible, especially this time of year, you know what I mean? Everyone's cold and people are looking for shelter and stuff like that.
Well, I've got a friend that's homeless, and I met a couple people. They tell me their story, how people treat them, whereas they're not treated right. There's a lot of prejudice going on. You know, it's sad, to be honest. Like, I've even helped homeless people create a home, like build
So, yeah, it's not great, and especially with COVID going on, it's getting worse for them as well, but I don't know, I'm not sure exactly what the solution is.
Ah, it's devastating. It's very prevalent.
I think it's really appalling, really. I think it's, you know, 2021, we've got this going on, and I think we should do something about it.
The Prince Philip should, and the Prime Minister should, build good housing for them, like mud, give them a special tree, because they're homeless. Instead of normal houses they build for people made of sand and stones.
How do you feel about the fact there's so much homelessness in Britain? Because there is a lot. 200,000 people, in fact.
Yeah, it's a really big figure, and it's really alarming for the UK citizens, yeah, definitely.
Especially in UK, it's quite disappointing to see people are still rough sleeping, and especially in this poor weather and during pandemic, it's difficult.
Just for people, it's too expensive. The, you know, the rent prices and stuff.
There's so many of them. I've lived in Britain since 1989. I have never seen that many homeless people ever in my life before.
What do you think about the fact there's so much homelessness in Britain now?
Well, because I think the inequality is, I mean, you know, increasing. So social system is breaking down, and that's why the homelessness is there.
As Boris Johnson lives comfortably in his Downing Street apartment, others live rough in the streets of the capital. How does the public feel about that?
He's the Prime Minister of UK. So he have to live in a security place. He can't live just like us ordinary people.
If Prime Minister lives in a warm place, he must ensure that people which he rules, they should stay in the warm houses, at least in Christmas, I think.
Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, I think he doesn't give a toss about what's happening on the streets, to be honest.
So I don't think it's fair for him to have a certain rule for himself and the rest. We have the rules of seeing people sleeping outside, you know. I mean, I'm not a rich man, but if I had more space, I'll invite somebody in my house to for the night.
Honestly, I don't think he really cares about homeless people. Like, he's only cares for himself, if he's, you know what I'm saying. Like, apparently he's been partying along like, around the coronavirus time, so I don't think he's a great Prime Minister for us to actually do it.
I think he's looking at the national security, he's got other issues on his mind. Now I think with the homeless is that just like we do a petition for everything, why don't we do a petition for the homeless?
He don't bother anybody. He's a joker. A real joker. Real comedian. Our minister is a real comedian.
To be honest, I don't think Boris has done enough for a lot of things. I think in his mind, the homeless crisis is probably bottom of his list.
No, he hasn't, but at the same time, he's got way more on his plate as well. Yes, it's always been an issue, and homelessness is something that's an issue everywhere in the world, not just in London and England.
I don't feel as though he's addressed the issue in an adequate way whatsoever. Sadly, though, I feel as his policies are part of a larger conservative agenda to minimise spending and focus on finance in London, which is a shame. But I don't feel like he's kind of a puppet of the Conservative Party, so it's not essentially his problem. It's more of an issue with the changing dynamic of politics within Britain.
Oh, we need to change all of our behaviour, thinking and attitudes as well. It's not for only Boris Johnson, it's also the people thinking. We need to change this one.
This is really disgusting that some people are too wealthy and other people have nothing to sleep.
Boris Johnson is Boris Johnson, isn't it? He can afford it. That's his job.
I don't know how the people like him or me can sleep in peace while the other people are sleeping rough.
It's hard for me to say, really. I think in terms of the amount of money that's going towards the scheme and in terms of helping other homeless people, it's more money definitely could go into places that need it most, you know, to deprived areas, which can be across all of England.
Why has homelessness gone up so much in the UK? And has COVID had an impact?
I think last 2 years, maybe a pandemic has affected this because, you know, most of the people became unemployed. But I think the main reason here is there is a strict you know, common rules in here, and community don't want to accept someone who not belongs to their, you know, who not familiar with them.
Well, I think there's different reasons. First of all, like, there's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of the Brexit has had a massive impact on like people applying for benefits and so on, and then also I think the refugees is another one, and
maybe people are not giving it more thought, you know. I'm not saying to demonstrate about it, but just to make your opinions known and your feeling, you know. Positive action and non-violence, that's it.
The lockdown, which has now taken away people's jobs so they can't actually get a job, or something else that has happened in their family?
Because there are more people who are struggling to find a job, they're struggling to earn money, and that there's not enough places for them to live.
I think that's because of the government spending is going towards war and so on.
Especially during COVID and stuff like that, I imagine loads of these places, you know, shut down, like the hostels and certain places where homeless people would have, you know, like an outlet almost, somewhere to go and somewhere to stay. And obviously, during COVID, it's that messed up a lot of things, I'd imagine.
Less jobs. Economy, maybe.
Well, partially it's due to the pandemic, obviously, with people losing their jobs and whatnot. Rising inflation, all of these things take a part into it as well.
I feel as though freer liberal markets in Britain, and us having the paradigm of neoliberalism is squeezing the amount of spending that governments can focus on it. Things like economic crises become broader issues which are taken more of a priority.
I think housing, probably a lot to do with housing. There's a lot of people coming into the country as well, which is also probably contributing to not enough beds, not enough spaces. You know,
there are not accurate policies in place to make sure that everyone is taken care of appropriately.
Well, myself, I'm self-employed, and I felt a big difference, yeah, to be honest. You know, before COVID and now, it's much difficult to get clients and, you know, make more money.
As long as I know, COVID, during the COVID lockdown and things, you know, they did increase that, you know, that accommodation so people were, I mean, you know, given the accommodation, but definitely financially, mentally and physically, people are suffering a lot, actually, yes.
Here's the size of the problem. 11,580 single households were assessed as sleeping rough when asked. That's an increase of 39.4% compared to 2019-20. Families involving black ethnicity are disproportionately homeless. They account for 9.7% of those officially seen as needing support, but they only make up 3.5% of the population. Overall, in 2019-20, over 258,000 received homelessness assistance, a huge number for one of the world's most wealthy countries.
How do people here in the city feel about the fact that a first world country such as Britain still has so many individuals living in a housing crisis or even sleeping rough?
All of them, most of them is drugs, alcoholics, and this for this reason they don't want to get into flat, because if the government give them a flat, they can't pay the rent. They can't pay the rent, they can't keep the flat maintained. So how can the government will help them out?
I was thinking that Britain is one of the most wealthy countries in the world, But when I came here, I saw a lot of people in the cities. They were living in the streets, and literally they were eating from the no garbage.
I think we're very selfish. We don't really care about people next door. I think we're losing the sense of community, and until we go back to this community, minded people, that we're not going to sort homelessness or any other issue, poverty or whatever, drugs or whatever.
I'm just surprised it's happening. The money is here. They could do it if they want to do it. This is how I feel about it.
We've been supported by 3 different countries, and we still can't provide for people to actually become stable. And I feel like that's upon our Prime Minister and other associates.
There's always a solution if you want to find it, I would say. If people say there's not a magic money tree, but I guess if you really wanted to find the money, then you probably could somewhere. It's just where that money's going and where the government wants to prioritise.
Well, like Indira Gandhi said once, do you know what she said? I'll move from Bombay all the poor, so there will be no poor in India, Bombay. And Mr. Boris Johnson will do the same. Move all the poor from London and it will be rich London.
People aren't, I feel like we're not doing enough. I feel like we're focused on the wrong things, you know what I mean? On the news every morning it's this and that. And, you know, there's always another problem, and majority of the time it's about COVID or... I just feel like there's so many problems at the moment that...
In life you usually just focus on yourself, but, you know, it's also nice to think about other people, but... You see, the people up there, the Prime Minister and stuff, they only think about themselves.
When you're dealing with things like homelessness, just giving them money isn't going to fix the issue. They need to learn what to do with the money, how to make the money stretch for them forever, you know, what to do with investing, pensions, getting jobs, things like that.
Governments are disassociated from people in Britain, and the other issues have become a higher priority, such as sort of economic sustainability and international competitiveness of Britain, rather than there's just no sort of community spirit voting for Labour movements and left-wing movements. There's no collective action anymore.
It is really frustrating. It is really frustrating, and it is really the hamper of the British peoples.
I do know that, you know, society is complaining, people's complaining.
When I'm walking and if I see it, I feel so bad. I mean, you know, I'm lucky enough to have, a shelter on my, head. But when you see the, it's the first world country, developed country, there's no shortage of money. But sadly, those people are sleeping rough, not looked after.
What is the future for the United Kingdom when the streets of its capital have become home for over 10,000 people?
We know this, like, rich people are getting richer, poor people are getting poorer, which obviously is going to lead to more people being homeless. And the housing in London especially is ridiculous, it's so expensive. How many people can actually afford, you know, to buy a house, to rent a decent place that they can go home? Not many people.
Well, I don't see where we're going. Hopefully I'll be standing and be able to demonstrate about it with no violence. You know, I'll talk about it. That's all you need to do, you know. Just show the government that this should not happen. You know, people should not sleep outside, especially in this cold weather.
One thing is, I'm also not blaming only nation, because some people can work and they should work. And those who cannot, they should get help.
To be honest, I think it'll only get worse. I don't think, hopefully, because like you say, we do have the resources to help these people, you know what I mean? And, you know, they're all, especially at the moment, like you said, I don't know what the number was, but 10,000, you know, people going to sleep, especially, like I said, during winter, it's freezing.
Well, it's either going to increase or it's going to go lower until the Prime Minister does something. And he's not doing much right now.
Although homelessness has gotten worse over the first few years, look back 30, 40 years, maybe even more, it has gotten much better since then. Unemployment has gone down loads and loads. So it is getting better. Like I said, because of how complex it is, it's going to take many, many years.
The future is just to get worse, currently. if it continues down this road, then there will be no momentum or motivation to change anything unless something fundamental changes within the parliamentarian system.
I think there's a lot more than 10,000, to be honest with you. I don't think there is 10,000. I mean, you've only got to go up and down London and you see them on the trains, you see them on the roads.
Unless we have a change in the government, I cannot see anything positive. I think there is a need for a government who would be sympathetic, who would understand the actual issues. If you are living in a mansion, I am not too sure how would you understand the difficulties and issues people facing on the street.
I think it's going to be even more, to be honest. If nothing's going to change, it's going to get worse. Yeah, because the young generation is growing as well. They're struggling to get jobs. They're struggling to get a property or to afford to rent. It's going to get worse, yeah.
Well, it's not sending a good image, if you ask me, but I think the whole world is the same, really. It's not just Britain. But I think it's going to get better. Let's just hope it gets better.
I think I had my time. Perhaps the next generation is going to be getting even tougher time. So, in one hand, the government is borrowing billions and hundreds of billions of pounds. Nobody knows where it's going. But the next generation has to pay. And perhaps, sadly, the homeless people will be the last one to be in the queue to get the help.
Mr. John Sparks, the chief executive of Homeless Charity Crisis, has said, "You cannot free people from the cycle of homelessness without a proper home and, crucially, the support they need to keep it long-term." Amnesty International adds that frontline services warn they are at breaking point due to a rise in homelessness and that the UK could be facing a human rights catastrophe. At the same time, when it comes to housing difficulties, black households are particularly at risk.
As the UK experiences yet another rise in COVID-19, and as Boris Johnson appears focused on his own survival, his government struggles to solve the homelessness issue. The Prime Minister could himself be evicted from Downing Street. Yet his problems are small compared to being homeless or sleeping rough day after day, while the government's COVID crisis has made it even less able to help one of the most vulnerable groups in the country, people with nowhere to live.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.